The Rig Veda, Jahur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Mahabharata, Pancharatra, and original Ramayana are all considered Vedic literature. The Puranas, such as the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Naradiya Purana, Vishnu Purana, and Bhagavad Purana, are especially meant for Vaishnavas and are also Vedic literature. As such, whatever is stated within the Puranas, the Mahabharata and Ramayana, is self-evident. There is no need for interpretation. Bhagavad Gita is also within the Mahabharata. Therefore, all the statements of Bhagavad Gita are self-evident. There is no need for interpretation. And if we do interpret, the entire authority of Vedic literature is lost. Strong words. And Prabhupada, 2 times he says, there is no need for interpretation, you know, and self-evident also comes up a few times. So this, yeah, we have here Lord Chaitanya speaking in response to Sarva Bhauma Bhattacharya's imaginative explanations. And as Prabhupada says, there is these 4 types of evidence: direct perception, hypothesis, historical reference, and the Vedas. And out of all those, the Vedas are the foremost. This is, of course, not understood these days at all. These days, people are mainly, you know, attached to direct perception, what they can see, or maybe also scientific research, you know. But actually, even scientific research also actually is influenced by these 4 things which make direct perception limited, namely making mistakes, being illusioned, cheating, imperfect senses. You know, these are the 4 main defects which make direct perception not very authentic at all, right? So, yeah, I mean, we can say that the verse and the topic is a pretty important one, if not to say almost a bit of a challenging one, and maybe for some even a bit of a hot topic, if not to say controversial topic. So I had to smile to myself that exactly I get such a verse, but what to do? It is all for my purification here. But let us start with this point. You know, if Prabhupada emphasizes there is no need for interpretation. So if Shastra is self-evident, so why do we need Prabhupada's purports then? Right? That was the first question coming to my mind. This could very well be asked, you know. And like I know, for example, in Bangladesh, they have this one volume of all the Bhagavatam verses without the purports. And they always like to distribute this, but I'm always saying to them, you know, people need Prabhupada's purports. No need to distribute this book so widely. What do they understand? So, you know, I'm sure we all agree, you know, how much we actually need Prabhupada's purports, you know. I mean, very often we come across sections in the Bhagavatam where I'm marveling, you know, how Prabhupada unpacks, unfolds all kinds of verses. If we didn't have Prabhupada's purports, you know, we actually wouldn't really understand much, you know, even though it says the Vedas are self-evident. Well, not to us. So we do need Prabhupada's purports. And yeah, I mean, I think we cannot even remember often enough what Prabhupada actually did, his amazing contribution to the humanity in this Kali Yuga, that he made, you know, the essence of of the Vedic literature, really the essence available to everyone in a simple language with practical application. I mean, he really did such an amazing thing, which I think we don't even fully understand. And Prabhupada was often saying that how his books are the law books for the next 10,000 years, you know, yes. And sometimes, you know, in Vyasa Puja homages, we also hear Prabhupada being glorified that he came with a mission of Matsya Avatar, who saved the Vedas, you know. And that actually is really a wonderful description of Srila Prabhupada, you know, and his contribution. Because if it wasn't for him, you know, that knowledge was almost getting completely lost, you know, almost completely lost, you know. And not only did Prabhupada make this knowledge, the essence of this knowledge, available to the whole world, to the English-speaking world, but he also re-established the proper Siddhanta of bhakti amongst the Hindus, you know, that I have very often really directly experienced, because I'm often preaching in Hindu areas, Nepal, India, Bangladesh, to the Hindu community. And if it wasn't for Prabhupada's books, people would be completely confused. I mean, really, you know, who to worship. And I mean, people are so mixed up, so confused. There would be no hope for them, really, you know, even amongst the Hindu community, you know. So, and like in Bangladesh, people often say, well, the people first have to join ISKCON and then they should read Prabhupada's books. Now, I'm always telling them, no, it's the other way around. They first have to read Prabhupada's books and then they will join ISKCON, and it will not be some sentimental thing. Today people like ISKCON, tomorrow they don't like ISKCON. But if our joining of ISKCON is really based on Prabhupada's books, then it is a whole different thing. You know, and even though there may be some things happening which we don't like, but we stick to ISKCON and Prabhupada because of his books, you know, what he made available really to the whole world, you know. And also let's remember, Prabhupada actually, he used all the different commentaries of so many previous acharyas, you know, and he amalgamated them, or he took something from this person, that person, from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Sixth Goswamis, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta, Baladev Vidyabhushan. So when he was writing, what I've heard, he had a whole pile of books there next to him, and he was looking here, looking there, and very often he refers to them in the purports that he says, yes, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says this, and so on, you know. So he did not make his own commentaries, but it was very much based on previous acharyas, you know, and Prabhupada himself, he was often saying, actually, I don't write these books. You know, Krishna is dictating through me. I'm simply the instrument, you know, and also Guru Govinda Maharaj gives this nice analogy also for a writer or even a speaker. You know, he says the writer or speaker is simply like the connecting pipe, connecting the audience with the nectar which is coming from the Lord, not from the speaker. You know, he is simply the connecting pipe. And as soon as the speaker thinks, oh, all this nectar is coming from me, then already pipe is blocked. You know, nothing comes through. So, you know, that consciousness one has to have when one speaks or writes, that actually the nectar is already there. It is not coming from us. It is coming from the Lord himself. And the more, yeah, pure we are, purity is the force. So the more we can actually really let the whole flow of nectar flowing through us as instrument. And that attitude definitely had Srila Prabhupada, you know, and he was always emphasizing this, that he is actually not writing but it is really Krishna dictating. And why did Krishna choose Prabhupada? You know, because he especially came on that mission, and he is so pure. He lives by these principles of Bhagavatam and the scriptures. You know, there's complete absence of false ego. So therefore, you know, Krishna reveals to him and acts through him. And that's how we got Prabhupada's wonderful explanations. You know. And then there's also this nice little story. It was after a Bhagavad Gita class in America, I believe, where one lady in the audience asks, "So why is your Bhagavad Gita so popular?" And Prabhupada gives this nice answer. He says, "Because it's not my Bhagavad Gita. It's Bhagavad Gita as it is." And this title, Bhagavad Gita as it is also very wonderful because, yeah, well, that is the essence of this today's verse and purport, that it's not his interpretation, but it is as it is, you know. And Prabhupada says, "It's not my Bhagavad Gita. It's Bhagavad Gita as it is. It's not Bhagavad Gita how you think it to be or how you would like it to be, but it is as it is." So Prabhupada, in a wonderful way, he makes this very point, you know. And as we all know, you know, there's so many Bhagavad Gita's interpretations, imaginative interpretations, but as we know, they have not transformed a single person's heart. They have not produced any devotees, you know. So there is, you know, definitely so much Shakti there, you know, in Prabhupada's commentary. So now we could say, well, maybe we can make a difference between giving commentary and interpretation, right? You know, depending, of course, how we define the terms. But yes, I would like to define it now in such a way that we say, yes, commentary is written from a highly advanced, pure soul, you know, who receives the revelations directly from the Lord. There is no personal interest, no material attachments, no false ego, no credit, no desire of wanting to, you know, be recognized and unique and, oh, look at my interpretation here or something. No, there's no room for this. So this is what we could now call a commentary. That's what Prabhupada gave us, the purports, you know, really not even the slightest tinge of material motivation is there, right? So, and in contrast to that, the interpretation, I mean, Prabhupada even says it in the purport. He says, how does it, let me quickly see. "If we want to interpret the Vedic version, we must imagine an interpretation according to what we want to do." So that exactly makes the point, you know, that interpretation, there is more, you know, this attachment, what do I, you know, need this for, you know, what do I want to do, what is my material intention here and attachment and so on, my personal motive, and, you know, then we interpret according to our material desires and attachments to actually protect them, to maintain them, you know. And yes, so, and then this is distorting the essence of the Shastra, you know. Yes. So, and we can say, well, this is, of course, going on in the world today because people have so many material attachments and motives and desires and intentions and wanting recognition and. But also we have to admit, you know, we ourselves are also not free of these tendencies, yeah, that this creeps in into our spiritual life, you know, and we can basically say, as long as we have material attachments and desires, and I think we have to admit we all have them, so we have to be very, very careful, because interestingly, also, as long as we have material attachments and desires, actually, there is no objective hearing experience. We all hear something different, you know, because interestingly, you know, even receiving the knowledge from the Shastra is also through sensual perception, through the ears, you know. So, and then we underlying these defects of being an illusion, trying to cheat, imperfect senses, you know. So this also affects us when we hear the Shastra. So, yeah, and I mean, this is good to understand. There is no objective hearing or objective experience, you know. We may come across this in our daily lives, that people experience the one and the same situation very differently. And sometimes the way they tell what happened can be so differently that you almost wonder, are we talking about the same incident, or are you talking about something else? So depending on our consciousness, you know, our material attachments and motives, even according to our attitude towards a speaker, a person, you know, that already affects what we hear, how we hear. You know, if we have a negative, you know, attitude towards a speaker, then already we are a little blocked, you know, or if we have a proud attitude or something, you know, we hear completely different than when we like a person, you know, and we have respect for that person and so on. So simply our hearing is very much affected by our consciousness and our attitude. So in understanding this makes it very clear, you know, how careful we have to be, you know, with our interpretations of the Shastra, you know. Because very often we come across this, that we have material attachments, desires. We are not so easily eager to, you know, give them up. So we kind of, we hear things in such a way to protect our material attachments and desires. We don't want to, you know, have somebody touching upon them, you know. So, yeah, it takes actually deep humility and honesty, you know, to actually see where am I and what is the Shastra advising, you know, and then to be able to admit, oh, well, sorry, I'm not on that level, you know, I cannot live up to this, but I clearly understand this should be the goal, this should be the standard, which we should all strive for, you know. But very often, because we are lacking humility and honesty, you know, we rather want to lower the level, you know, and the standards to suit our level and our attachments. This, yeah, is something that creeps in, you know. Very, very commonly. I mean, I don't even want to take any examples, not to get caught up in any kind of discussions or something. But yeah, it's really, we have to be very careful, you know, because also, you know, talking about false ego affects the intelligence and the mind. False ego is a very contaminating element, you know, and it contaminates the intelligence. And then the contaminated intelligence sometimes really distorts things just to suit our, you know, ego satisfaction. You know, yes, this all creeps in, you know, yes. Sometimes distorts things to such an extent that we find it hard to believe that, you know, other people are talking about the same thing as we talk, you know. So, yeah, that's why we have to be very, very careful, you know, recognizing that, yes, as long as I have material desires and attachments, my hearing, my understanding is clouded. And that's why we need so much, you know, Prabhupada's purports. And that's why we always need these two references of Guru Sadhu Shastra. And I mean, in this regard also, I have heard Prabhupada disciples sharing how Prabhupada used to immediately interfere when devotees start a sentence with, I think, you know, in classes also, if a speaker says, I think, then Prabhupada already, no, we don't care what you think. This is not how we should speak, not what you think, you know, but, you know, it has to be according to Shastra, you know, not what we think. So, and of course, you know, this whole topic of Shastra is self-evident and we don't need any interpretation. This also brings us to the topic of principles in detail, you know. This is also often something we kind of miss a little bit, you know, that we don't understand. There is underlying principles in the Shastra and they have to be preserved. But then the detail may differ, you know, according to time, place, and circumstance. And very often, like, for example, Vanaprastha Ashram, when you read Bhagavatam Vanaprastha Ashram, I've got a whole course on that also. You know, if you read Vanaprastha Ashram, you know, you think, oh my God, this is, you know, so such heavy rules and regulations and, you know, this and that. You know, but no, we extricate the underlying principles and we preserve them and we can apply them in the modern context of Lord Chaitanya Sankirtan movement. So it doesn't mean that Vanaprastha, you have to go to the forest, but we extricate the principles of forest life and we can apply them wherever we are, in London or New York or whatever. You know. So yeah, that is not always easy because sometimes we take a detail and we establish that as a principle and then we go wrong, you know. So I want to quickly read you one little thing here from Bhujan Prabhu, from my glorious master. He describes a little incident when Shuddha Kirti Prabhu was asking Prabhupada about this, you know. So Bhujan Prabhu remembers, Shuddha Kirti, as he moved the massage to, Shuddha Kirti Prabhu, as he moved to massage Prabhupada's side, asked, Prabhupada, how can we tell the difference between making an adjustment and changing a principle? Prabhupada's eyes closed and Shuddha Kirti continued to massage. After a few moments, Prabhupada opened his eyes and said, that takes a little intelligence. And then Bhujan Prabhu explains further, Shuddha Kirti's question was penetrating, clearly delineating between the adjustable and non-adjustable, between a detail and a principle is not easy. It requires intelligence. To foolishly mistake a non-adjustable principle for an adjustable detail will cause havoc in spiritual life. And to accept each detail as if it can never be adjusted is fanaticism. Fanaticism will cause havoc of a different nature. If we have developed our spiritual intelligence, we can make distinctions between principles and details. but we should confirm our opinions with trusted friends or superiors, meaning guru, sadhu, shastra, basically. If we haven't developed our spiritual intelligence, we should take guidance from those who have. We should not act independently. So a nice little story, you know, even though we don't have the time now to explore this more, what is the detail and principle. So in any case, you know, we have to be careful, because if the principles do get lost, you know, due to our lowering the standards, because we want to adjust to, you know, our attachments and desires, then the process can become watered down, you know. Yes. And I do, to finish off this discussion, because I want to leave a little bit of time for another time, let's tackle also. I do want to read some quotes from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and they are pretty heavy, I warn you. But, well, it fits to the topic, you know. I think they're both from Amritavani, from this wonderful book, Amritavani. There, Bhaktisiddhanta says, if I stop preaching the unbiased truth due to fear that people will not like it, I'm accepting the non-Vedic way, rejecting the Vedic way. Then I become an atheist and I lose my faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the personification of truth. Wow, pretty heavy, strong words, you know. Yes. Yeah, so, and interesting how he says, then I become an atheist. So, I mean, actually, you know, we can say, yes, we like Krishna, but often we don't like his system and his culture. And, and we can say in a very subtle way, this almost borders onto atheism, you know. How much faith do we really have, you know? And, yeah, I mean, we should not be too fearful that people will not like it. Of course, it's, again, touchy topic, because on one hand, we also don't want to confront people too much with a, you know, with the day and night principle, you know, day of the materialist is night to the introspective sage, and the other way around. So we don't want to confront people who live in the day of the materialist with a night of the materialist, which is the day of the spiritualist. But yeah, I mean, Prabhupada himself was often attacked, you know. He said so many heavy things in the Bhagavatam, and often he was attacked for it. But there's so many quotes where he said, well, yeah, people don't like it, but somehow we have to discuss these things, you know. And there's another nice quote also from Bhaktisiddhanta. Why broadcasting the truth is rare. Everyone is eager for adoration by others. Here we go, false ego. Not for the absolute truth. Those who make a show of being preachers do not disturb mankind, but rather maintain everyone's present mentality while busily protecting their own existence. Yeah, so that watered down preaching, you know, only leads to the point that we maintain our present mentality and that present mentality of others, but we want to actually transform it, not maintain it. Therefore, there is no propagation of the truth today in Kali Yuga, since one's popularity is not served by speaking or hearing the truth. Wow, yes. Sometimes we become unpopular when we speak the truth. Pure items are rare and not easily attainable, and so are not much appreciated. Similarly, there is no respect for those who do not misguide people, but are busy trying through Sankirtan and Harikatha to turn them towards the Lord. At present, it is fashionable to be cheated by those who in the name of Dharma misguide people. Real devotees do not speak to satisfy their audiences. They do not cheat people. Rather, pure devotees reveal the defects of cheaters who love to compromise. Only fortunate persons learn to be cautious after hearing the words of saints. Although the words of genuine devotees may appear to contradict our present taste and experience, nonetheless, they're most auspicious for us. Yeah, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, heavy words, you know. And yeah, I think we can, you know, take this. Of course, it's always easy to read this with this understanding, oh yeah, this is Kali Yuga, all outside ISKCON, you know, what people all preach and cheating and. But I think we also have to be humble to say, well, as long as we're not pure devotees, you know, this tendency also can sneak into our humble preaching efforts. And therefore, we have to be cautious, you know, we have to be cautious. And I mean, you know, remembering different heavy points that Prabhupada makes in the Bhagavatam about so many topics, I find it is a challenge to our faith. You know, how much faith do we actually have in Prabhupada's words? You know, and I mean, I do want to develop unflinching faith, and I take everything as it is, what Prabhupada says, you know, whether I like it or not, and whether it suits my attachments and desires and tastes or not. Oh, well, if it doesn't suit my attachments and tastes and desires, then I should be humble and honest enough to say that, but not doubt Prabhupada's words. Yeah. You know, that's a dangerous mentality, you know. Yeah. And then very easily things can get lost, you know. And I mean, it did happen in the Vaishnav history, you know, again and again, after Mahaprabhu left, also whole Vaishnavism became something different. You know, even then already that tendency was there. What to speak of now, Kali Yuga. So the tendency is even more there that things can come watered down and lost and yeah, misinterpreted through our imaginative interpretations. Okay, well, time is flying. Yeah, let us just take only very few questions, if there's any, because we do have now Tamdas Thakur's appearance, and I do want to say a few words about him also. Is there any questions?
Right now, we've not had any questions coming in, but I think at the end we will have some and can ask them then. So you could just go on and...
Okay. Okay.
Is that okay for you?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of making it in two blocks, you know, because once there's so different topics, you know, and once we start with now Tamdas Thakur, then maybe people hardly remember what the first part was all about. But I mean, if there's nothing, then we'll just continue. Yeah?
Yes, please. I think that would be fine. Thank you.
Yeah, so now, topic change to Narottamdas Thakur. I mean, again, I don't feel qualified to talk about him. Actually, Sitala Mataji wrote a wonderful book about Narottamdas Thakur. She would be so much more qualified to speak about him, really. And yes, let us remember, whenever the Lord appears, some of his eternal associates come before his appearance, some with him when he appears, and also some after he appears, or after he already disappeared, you know. So, and Narottamdas Thakur is one of those personal associates who appeared after Mahaprabhu already disappeared, you know, and also after quite a few of his associates disappeared. And he appeared in East Bengal, which is today Bangladesh. So I have actually several times visited all these places in connection with Narottam Das Thakur. They are very, very special places, really. And let me first of all remind everybody that actually so many, if not to say most, of Mahaprabhu's associates come actually from East Bengal, which is Bangladesh today, you know. Like even recently we had Advaita Acharya's appearance. So he also comes from Bangladesh, not from Shantipur. He went there later, you know. But his birthplace is in Bangladesh. And Srivas Thakur also, and Jagannath Mishra, Satchimata, Mahaprabhu's parents, you know. And Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, you know, they all come from that area. I mean, Bangladesh is like has a wealth of jewels there, you know. So, Pundarik Vidyanidhi, Mukunda Datta, Vasudev Datta. I mean, they all come from there, you know. You can almost say, you know, every place is a holy place there because it is has this strong heritage of Vaishnav culture and our Vaishnav line. And because it is a Muslim country today, that actually is really a blessing in disguise because that preserves our Vaishnav culture, you know, because the Muslims are not so fond of all kinds of Kali Yuga ideas and so on. And that keeps everything so intact and so beautiful. And when I visit there, it's almost like I always feel like I'm entering Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's really how it is. You know, the whole bhajan, kirtan, prasadam, Vaishnava hospitality culture, it's all still going on, full on, full on. You know, and the devotees, they all know, oh, this is Mahaprabhu's favorite chak and this and that. You know, they all know so many things, you know, so many things. So, and yeah, and we get some insights how beautiful and sweet this Vaishnav culture actually is. It is full of beauty and sweetness, and there's so much affectionate dealings, and you know, people don't feel so threatened by all their lusty impressions, you know, and they have, you know, here in the Western world, we are so traumatized with all lusty impressions, and we all have to, you know, put all our walls up and this and that. But you know, this Bangladesh is like a different planet. It really is. So much affectionate dealings, you know, very, very wonderful place, you know. So, yes, I want to use this as an opportunity to urge you, if whenever Corona is a little over and done, then make a visit to Bangladesh and let me know. I will arrange it all and so on, you know. So in any case, you know, Narottam Das Thakur, his mother was Naraini, his father Krishnananda Das, he was a king. So, and he appeared in Khetri, which is in Rashai district. You know, it is in the northwestern part of Bangladesh. And he is really an embodiment of our Gaudiya Vaishnav teachings and culture, you know. And he's so known through his poetry, through his beautiful songs. Many of them we do sing every day here, Guru Vandanam, and, you know, Nilo Premadana, we like to sing when a Vaishnava departs, and Gauranga Bulitabe, Hari Haraya Namakrishna, all these songs, you know, like this song, Hari Haraya Namakrishna. This is almost like a folk song in Bangladesh. Every kid knows it. Yes. Yeah, so they all grow up with these bhajans of Narottam Das Thakur, you know, and they can sing them so sweetly and so on, you know. And I mean, Narottam Das Thakur was also known for his beautiful voice, very sweet voice, also for his expertise in mridanga playing. The devotees told me there that he knew 45 different beats, which, I mean, I don't know how to play mridanga, but apparently it's quite amazing to know so many beats. So, yeah, and I mean, he really spread his love for Krishna through his songs, through his very self, and through his preaching. And Narottam means the topmost person. Nara, the person, Uttama, topmost, you know. And already at his appearance, you know, people could recognize that he has very amazing bodily features of a Mahapurusha, of a divine personality, you know, that he had very long arms, a deep navel, golden complexion, lotus eyes, beautiful big lotus eyes, and so on. So immediately, already as a small child, he stole the hearts of everyone there, you know. And at school, he could just memorize everything, what he heard once, you know. He was known to be a Shruti Dara, just hearing once and knowing, you know, that the teachers were amazed, you know, who is this child? He must be some outstanding personality, you know. And, yeah, as we know, most likely he did go to Vrindavan and accept the diksha there of Lokanath Goswami. Actually, Lokanath Goswami also comes from what is today Bangladesh. He comes from Jessore district, a little bit more south of where Narottam Das comes from. And Narottam took shiksha of Jiva Goswami. Actually, Lokanath Goswami instructed him to learn, you know, and study the scriptures under Jiva Goswami's guidance. You know? And yes, but there is one amazing story. I mean, there is probably a few amazing stories, but one is there that I think it was when he was 12 or something. He had a dream. Mahaprabhu appeared in his dream, and he went to the Padma River to take bath. And Mahaprabhu had left a pot of prema there for him. You know, Mahaprabhu predicted that there will be a special personality appearing. And when Mahaprabhu was traveling to Vrindavan, he was at some stage, he was calling out, Narottam, Narottam, you know. So he predicted that he will come. And Mahaprabhu was saying, yes, Kirtan is my life and soul. And Narottam will maintain it. He will take it further. So, yes. And Lokanath Goswami, he already left Vrindavan long before, actually. Long before. Before Narottam appeared, you know. And then there was this, this Leela, where Narottam took bath in the Padma River. And that place is also there today. You can visit that place where Lord Chaitanya kept that pot of prema in the Padma River, and where Narottam took bath and received a complete transformation. Even his bodily appearance changed, in the sense that his dark color was transformed into a golden color. And he went completely mad in ecstasy. And he was just dancing all night on the banks of the Padma River and so on. He didn't even want to go to the royal palace anymore and so on. So he was completely transformed through this bath in the Padma River, and there's also a nice little temple there. And there's also one place where there's a beautiful big tree and a platform underneath where he wrote his bhajans and his poetry, and where he was in separation and meditation of Krishna and Vrindavan and so on. So and then after this incident where he took this bath in the Padma River, You know, he had this complete urge to leave behind his royal palace and just join the six Goswamis in Vrindavan and so on. You know, he had this urge. He wanted to run away. It was almost a little similar to Raghunath Das. You know, he also came from such a royal family, and he had no attraction to all this opulence, and he was just wanting to run off all the time. So similar also with Narottam. And his parents wanted, of course, that he continues ruling the kingdom. You know, his father was a king. And as far as I remember, Narottam was the only son. So they really wanted to line up his marriage and have him take over the kingdom. But Narottam had no attraction for this whatsoever, you know, and he had this strong urge. And then finally, he succeeded in running away, and the guards were after him. They were catching him and wanting to bring him back. And then he makes this analogy. He says, just like a wife whose husband left the body, she enters the fire, the funeral fire. So Narottam said, I want to enter the fire of love of God, you know, and leave behind all the royal opulence and so on. So, and then finally they let him go, and then he went to Vrindavan. And yes, and already at the day when Narottam reached Vrindavan, finally after a long journey, I mean, this is quite amazing. People used to walk, you know, traveling meant walking. So today we just take a plane or bus or car or whatever. But he was walking all the way. I mean, that's quite a journey, you know, from Bangladesh, East Bengal to Vrindavan, walking. You know, so it was quite a journey. And there's also one little incident where was it Krishna or Mahaprabhu? I think Mahaprabhu appeared as a little golden cowherd boy and offered him a cup of milk and so on. You know, and during the long hardships of the journey, he had dreams of the six Goswamis who encouraged him to continue and you know. So, and then finally on the day when he reached Vrindavan, Lokanath Goswami also had a dream, you know, that Narottam arrived, and already Mahaprabhu had told him already before that there will be a personality called Narottam coming and he should initiate him. So it was really all, you know, Krishna's divine plan. And yes, but initially when Narottam wanted to take initiation of Lokanath Goswami, he actually didn't want to accept him because he had vowed not to accept any disciples. So he said, yeah, wait for 1 year and then we'll see. But then even after 1 year, he refused. So, and then Narottam, he did this most humble service, you know, that he went to the area where Narottam, Lokanath Goswami used to pass stool in the fields. He used to go and clean up that stool, you know. And Narottam, Lokanath Goswami noticed it and so on. And then, yeah, and finally he initiated him. And then also, you know, once Radharani appeared in his dream and told him that, you know, he is actually one of the assistants of the gopis who make milk sweets for Krishna every day, and that he is assisting them and working under Champakalata and helping to boil the milk. So, and then once Narottam, he was in meditation, he was performing the service of boiling the milk, and he burned his fingers in meditation. But then actually his hands were burned. you know, after this meditation. He had some burn marks on his fingers, and he was, you know, very shy, and he was hiding it with some cloth so nobody would notice it. But I think, you know, people did notice, some of them noticed, you know. So, yeah, it's very, very outstanding personality. So, and then later from Vrindavan, oh, yeah, he was completely heartbroken when he realized that Rupa and Sanatana Goswami had left their bodies, you know. He was completely heartbroken. But then Jiva Goswami was still there and the others. So, and then he spent some time there. But then later he came back to Khetri, and then there was also that famous story where him and Shamananda and Srinivas, they were supposed to take the Shastra, the Goswami literature, back to Bengal and start preaching there. But then they were stolen on the way and so on, and finally they got them back. So, but then one thing also, you know, that Lord Chaitanya in a dream appeared to Narottama and instructed him to reestablish the proper rules and regulations of deity worship. So, and then Narottama chose the Gopanim event, you know, Mahaprabhu's appearance, and he did this big, first big Gopanim festival at Khetri. Actually, by the way, let me mention this also. ISKCON recently repurchased some land in that area where Narottama Das Thakur appeared, and Khetri and so on, and we're just about to develop a project there, you know, because these things are so important. So ISKCON has to be established there, you know. So in any case, this first Gopanim festival was also a very outstanding event. You know, he arranged it with Srinivasacharya together. And actually, you know, that festival, through this festival, all the different lines of the Gaudiya Vaishnavas were joined again together, because they had kind of separated a little bit, also due to different interpretations and understandings. So even they had also happened, you know. They had their own understandings and mood and even kirtan starts and so on. But at this Gopanim festival, you know, they all came together, all of them. Many disciples of Nityananda Prabhu, Advaita Acharya and so on, they all came together. So it's a very memorable event, this first Gopanim festival. And there he also installed four sets of deities and reestablished the proper siddhanta of deity worship. And yeah, Janava Mata, she was still present then, you know. Nityananda Prabhu had already left this world, but Janava was still there. And she played a very instrumental role in unifying all these different moods and understandings and so on. So, yeah, she resolved actually their diverse conclusions and made it into one consistent Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. So she played a very, very important role there. And I mean, as we know, she's the Lord's eternal associate also. She's, you know, Shakti Tattva. So obviously she's not an ordinary Vaishnavi, if Vaishnavis are ordinary at all. But in any case, so, yeah, so many important things there. And also how Narottama Das Thakur left his body is also very unique and very amazing, that he actually took bath in the Ganga with his associates and disciples and followers. And he asked them to massage his body in the Ganga, and his body dissolved into milk. You know, my God. You know? And actually, it's described that his disciples, they caught some of that milk, you know, and Narottam was encouraging them, keep massaging, go on, you know. And they caught some of this milk, and apparently it is in his samadhi there in Vrindavan, is some of that milk that how in what he dissolved his body, you know. So yes, I mean, what can we say? Very, very extraordinary personality who, you know, who made such a big contribution to our Vaishnav line and our preaching mission. Okay, well, we've got only 3 minutes or something for questions, so I'm sorry it took a little longer. Yes, is there anything?
Thank you so much, Mataji. This was very wonderful descriptions. We have 2 questions, actually. Maybe we'll go first with the Narottam Das Thakur question. Hirsch Prabhu, he asks, is there a specific way we can meditate on the prayers, bhajans of Narottam Das Thakur in our japa? I don't have the same feelings as him. How can I develop them and meditate on his bhajans? Do I try to emulate their mood, or should I meditate on how I don't have their mood, but one day would like to have it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we have to be a little careful that we don't, you know, artificially jump higher than our level is, and we are not, you know, becoming sahajiyas, trying to, you know, imbibe Narottam Das Thakur's mood or something. At least I personally, I'm a little careful of this, you know. And I think, at least my humble self, I've got enough to do just to, in my japa, to long, you know, for this relationship and longing to serve, you know, really chipping away on the false ego by longing to serve that establishes us in dasya, in serving, you know. But I mean, definitely we can try and build a relationship to personalities like Narottam Das Thakur by reading about them. I mean, I highly, whoever hasn't read Sitala Mataji's book about Narottam Das Thakur, please read it. It's really very wonderful, you know. It's a wonderful book. So better, I would say, you know, better to read about these personalities, their glories, and try to develop respect and awareness, mindfulness of them, and become conscious of what wonderful saints and divine personalities we have in our line. And then, of course, as we know more about these personalities, when we read their bhajans, you know, then whatever we have heard about their life might come to our mind, and we can more deeply appreciate and absorb them. And then, if you get a chance, come to Bangladesh, visit these places, you know. And like that, we can gradually, get to know more of these personalities rather than just immediately jumping into their divine love or something, you know. We cannot really, at least, this is my humble realization, we cannot artificially try to cultivate it. That we first need some serious purification, you know. But we can meditate and get to know these personalities by reading about them and also singing their bhajans, trying more deeply understand, you know, their mood like that. Okay, last question.
Yes, Hanchi, thank you so much. This is really clear message. There's one question concerning the first block of your lecture. Yeah. So Nitya Rasa Mataji, she asks how there's one tricky thing about preaching the truth, saying the truth, because there's so many ideologies and ideas, and everyone says their one is the right one. So what is this something which will really allow us to have a true connection with the ultimate truth and to respect at the same time all the truths which is in connection with this ultimate truth, and not to look down on anyone in the world, notwithstanding the condition where they are.
Yeah, I mean, I came across, I think it's in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Chaitanya Shikshamrita, that he speaks also very strongly that we should not disrespect other religions, you know, and other lines, that we should not put them down and so on, you know, that we simply have to understand. So, there's something for everybody, and gradually, you know, as people become more elevated and more purified, then they will be more and more ready for the absolute truth and the highest path to go back home to Goloka Vrindavan. So, yeah, we have to be careful. And I mean, in regards to preaching, you know, of course, we have to be sensitive and not, you know, confront people, complete newcomers with hot issues or something. But yeah, prasadam, you know, prasadam is always the first main, our secret weapon, the prasadam. And then, yeah, Prabhupada's books, making friendship, you know. Actually, what was the essence of the question? Can you repeat one more time? What was the essence?
The essence is, what is this something which will really allow us to have a true connection with the ultimate truth, and at the same time respect all the truths in connection with this ultimate truth?
Well, I dare say, again, it's a false ego thing, you know. It's a false ego thing that the false ego wants to use anything and everything to, you know, give us that gratification that we know better. So as long as we are affected by the false ego, you know, then we will fall into these traps, and we don't know how to present things and how to be, you know, adjusting and accommodating to newcomers and their, you know, vision. So it is a matter of maturity, you know, that we become more and more free from the influence of false ego. I mean, anybody who preaches or even book distributors know you can really get caught on the false ego platform, you know, and in the street, if people say, no, thank you, I'm not interested, then we can't take the no for an answer, and we push and push, and that other person also gets caught on the false ego platform, says, no, forget it, I don't want it, you know. So this false ego is, yeah, I mean, that book I call Our Constant Companion and Troublemaker, so that's what it is. And it's just so subtle, so it infiltrates our preaching also, you know, and this narrow vision that, you know, everything has to fit in our square box there, you know. And I mean, just to finish off quickly, I have that experience with my mother, you know. She's 90 years old, and she's been to India with me twice, but still she likes the more deeper Christian thought. And now I don't have a problem with her, you know, reading together some of her Christian thinkers, and I discover there's so much similarity there, and, you know, and I pray with her together and so on, you know, and I can understand it's all about the same God, you know, it's all about Krishna. So, but that requires a bit of maturity, you know. Like 20 years ago, I was, you know, sticking to my Hare Krishna thing, you know, but now I've learned the art of, you know, accommodating her where she is, and still also uplifting her and making some little comments from our perspective. And that has made her so much more open even than what she was before. So it's a question of maturity and mainly false ego, you know. Yeah, that's what it is.
Thank you so much. This is a very beautiful description.